There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Welcome to another episode of the Nerdist Podcast, filled with semi-organized sounds for your listening slits. The Nerdist Podcast Live is on tour. Matt, Jonah, and I are coming to a region near you. Probably. Hopefully. We're going to be in Northampton, Massachusetts on November 30th. January 6th is our rescheduled DC date at the 930 Club. And then, very soon, next week in fact, we're going to have a bunch more dates that we're going to be announcing. So get details for these and all other shows at Nerdist.com. I would like to take a moment in this intro to thank the shit out of you. Guys, if you listen to this podcast with any regularity, you probably watch the Nerdist TV show, which aired on BBC America. And I want to thank you for that because BBC America has announced that we are doing 5 more Nerdist TV specials over the course of the next several months. They're going to follow some really cool event programming that they're going to be having. The first one will be on Christmas Eve on December 24th, just in case you forgot when Christmas Eve is. And then throughout next year. So these are going to be a super, super, super fun. We're going to plan a lot of big stuff for these, so you'll get more details for these as time marches on. But I just wanted to say a sincere thanks, because it's obviously a dream for us to get to make this show, because it's exactly what we love doing. So thank you! Some people come to me and they say, "Hey, Chris Hardwick, how do you produce podcasts?" And I say, well, a lot of times it's with the help of sponsors, like this one, Hover.com. This episode of Nerdist is brought to you by Hover. It's domain name registration made super, super, super simple. You go there, their UI is really clean. All they do is register domains for you. They don't try to sell you a bunch of other crappy services that you don't need. You can set up email addresses, forward email addresses, redirect domains to other website addresses, create URL extensions, set privacy controls. It's all with just a few clicks. So please go to hover.com. That's H-O-V-E-R. Try their domain management service. They make it easy for you to transfer your existing domains over to Hover. Just enter the name or URL that you want to transfer, and then Hover gives you the next steps and tracks the progress as the URL is transferred. So these guys are great. If you need to get a new domain, go to hover.com, H-O-V-E-R. Use the offer code Nerdist. And now the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 140. Holy shit, 140. Yeah. One of my favorite comedians, a super nice guy that I've known for 2 decades. It's Dana Gould.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
You just love those super serious show pictures. That's large been, format Polaroids.
I've used that super serious show picture as my 8x10 for it's like 3 years.
It's
put your mouth up next to that mic. Let's see how you sound.
That's why I wanted to do that show.
Hey.
Oh no, it's got to aim at you like a bullet, like a gun. Will it? Yeah.
How's that?
Oh yeah, much you got better. It. Dana J. Gould is here in the studio.
In my old neighborhood.
What, you used to live around here?
When I first moved to LA, I lived literally right around the corner.
I think we got it, Nick. I think we got it. We were able to make it stay in a way the microphone. Yeah, let's hang on to that though, because we'll need it again if that's all right. Thanks, Nick.
Not to stab a zombie in the eye.
Yeah. Oh, actually in the ear, original Dawn of the Dead style. It's
right into the ear.
It pulls up into the ear.
Good access to the brain that way.
Yeah, right in. Yeah. Slowly.
This was actually a New York Comic Con commercial, which didn't make sense. Flesh-eating zombies are here to eat your brains. Well, I thought they were flesh eating.
Yeah. Brains are for dessert.
Yeah.
Listen, they can't get to the brain without enjoying some of the flesh.
Yeah. Make up your mind, please.
Zombies just ask you. It's like, could you just please release the brain?
I honestly think the brains thing came from The Simpsons.
Brains? Oh, no. The first time I ever saw it come up was in Return of Living Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Dan O'Bannon.
Brains.
Yeah, more brains.
Yeah, I remember.
They eat brains to stop the pain. The pain of what? The pain of being dead. Yeah.
That's the something in the fluid. But zombies on the Atkins diet don't eat the skin. They just go right to the brain.
Yeah.
They just go right to the brain.
Zombies, yeah. Well, that would be the ultimate thing.
They're fancy. It's like the caviar.
Yeah.
And yeah.
That would be a great, just a quick thing, is like a zombie checking itself out in a store window. It's time for that.
Does my ass there's look your, big? It's actually show. Mostly rotted away. So, no.
The Voguing Dead.
I'm so glad that you're finally on the podcast. I'm sorry it took me so long to get you on here, Dana Gould. That's my fault.
Me too, Chris.
What the fuck?
Now it's time to fight.
Now I can't wake up every morning and go, Hardwick is my enemy.
Well, I can find another reason to help create the... I think it's important for people to have a nemesis, and then that's good.
It's true. I feel weird without an enemy.
Keeps you on your toes.
I have many nemesi.
Do you?
Yes.
Well, you seem to be Matt's nemesis sometimes.
Yeah.
Lovable.
That's when I was a kid. My older brother was my enemy, and now that he's no longer my enemy, there's an odd void in my life. You're a little off kilter.
Wasn't there I think there was a guy maybe on Craigslist who said, you know, I will be your nemesis. It was an ad, and then someone, was that a web video? I think I'm starting to mash up weird memes in my head.
Well, that was the whole point of, that was that great monologue in the otherwise poorly mishandled Unbreakable.
Yeah.
About how we need each other.
And
we're going to do a movie about how it would be like if there were superheroes and supervillains in real life. And then we'll have no one behave the way they behave in real life. Just to completely ruin the whole point of the movie.
But what bummed me out about that movie was that...
It started, it existed, and it ended.
So there you go.
Did you like Sixth Sense?
I did. Well, I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say, I wanted to see... Like, I'm sure in his mind, he thought, I'll leave it open-ended so people never know. And I'm like, well, I kind of want to know. Like, I wanted to see his kid shoot him in the kitchen and then have the bullet bounce off and be like, oh, fuck. You know,
It's sad. There are movies and there are movies. Another one is Mars Attacks, where I go, oh, golly, I wish I'd made this.
Yeah,
I would have done the joke. I would have told the joke properly.
Or not stacked a bunch of jokes on top of each other to muddle the entire thing.
Yeah. Mars Attacks. You need a straight man and then a funny man. You need Abbott and you need Costello. You can't have wacky aliens fighting slightly less wacky humans.
Yeah.
If you took, and Tom Kenny, I was talking about this with Tom Kenny, the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants.
He's been on the podcast.
And the Ice King from Adventure Time.
And a guy that I used to deliver lunches with. Really? In my crappy day job in Boston years ago. If you took the aliens from Mars Attacks and edited them into Independence Day in place of the aliens there, that's the movie.
Yeah. Oh, that would be awesome.
The people are playing it straight as a heart attack.
Yeah.
And the Martians are crazy and don't care. Then it's actually funny.
But that's
instead, you get the hilarious Glenn Close and the gut-busting Jack Nicholson.
Playing with Jack Nicholson. And Jack Nicholson.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, two roles in that one. But
I loved Martin Short in that movie, though. I thought Martin Short was pretty great in Mars Attacks.
Yes. But it was such a like, just like, God, why aren't I laughing? Yeah. I want to laugh so hard.
But that's the thing with those movies. It's like, you know, the comedy genre movies were just, that's why Shaun of the Dead was so good, is because, like, you know, the people reacting very funny towards a serious zombie situation.
Exactly. When the monsters don't know they're in a comedy, it works.
Yeah, exactly.
American Werewolf in London. Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah, yep. I was going to say that.
Oh, such a great movie.
One of the best movies. In fact, I was with the werewolf earlier this week.
I showed them the picture.
We already saw it.
I showed them the picture when we were in New York. I was like, look.
I was going to dine out on that picture right now.
Well, it's a podcast, so.
Yeah, true. I'm holding my phone up to the mic.
Describe it. It's a wolfy character.
Well, my friend Bob Burns is sort of like a famous collector.
Mm-hmm.
And he has all of this stuff in his house. His house is just like a mini museum of memorabilia. I mean, literally, the day he's doing a documentary. A documentary is being made about him.
There. Oh, wow.
That's the sentence. Sorry, I had a stroke.
It's okay.
I smell pennies.
No, it's fine. You're fine. You look okay. His face is drooping.
His face on one side.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I went over there to do it, and I was with the werewolf from American Werewolf in London. The alien queen from Aliens is there. The flying saucer from The Day the Earth Stood Still is hanging from the ceiling.
Sounds like a sitcom.
The last extant creature from the Black Lagoon suit. And more than anything, I held in my hand a gift to Bob from the Mercer Special Effects Studio, the 35-cent Lindbergh UFO commercially available model kit that a little director named Ed Wood put in a little movie called Plan 9 from Outer Space.
How did someone even find that? Why wasn't this stuff burned after they made that movie?
It was just Bob was a fan living in L.A. in the mid-50s, knew everybody. They said, hey, you have this? Sure, I'll take it.
Holy shit.
Wow.
Do you know Rich Carell?
I do.
Rich Carell is a guy who I think he was on Leave It to Beaver when he was a kid.
Uh-huh.
And then he became a television director and has spent a large portion of his fortune from television directing, which is very lucrative, by the way.
Yes.
In all seriousness, it really is. If you direct a pilot and that pilot gets picked up,
you get money every week
that show is on, whether or not you touch another episode again.
Jim Burrows, who did that for shows like Cheers and Frasier. I mean,
crazy.
Literally, it's just like they eat leaves and shit money.
Yeah,
it's just like
so. Rich Carell is a horror fanatic and has and he lives in this kind of mansion-y house, and every year he sort of brings out his horror collection, but he has like one of the original Exorcist dummies.
Whoa.
Like he's got some insane stuff in his collection. I'm sure he has a bunch of ape stuff, as Planet of the Apes stuff as well. I'm so sorry.
Blort.
Actually, Rob Zombie had one of the original apes costumes and wore it one year for Halloween.
What?
Yeah.
I'd be scared that it would fall apart.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
I have one of the original. I have two now. I have the pullover extras masks, the crappy chimpanzees. But I got it in the weirdest way. The way I got it was what was great. My wife and I, we used to live behind the Chateau Marmont.
Mm-hmm.
And our neighborhood had a parking problem. And we were having a little community neighborhood meeting. And there's this guy named Dan, this older guy named Dan, and he's talking about the parking from Dublin's was the car giving
us
a hard time.
That is dating that conversation.
Yeah. It was about 10 years ago, yeah. And I look at him, and then I walked up to him later, and I went, excuse me, are you Dan Strepek? Who was the head of the Fox makeup department in the late 60s that I knew from reading Starlog and Famous Monsters and everything. And it was like he stepped back like I slapped him almost. It was just he was that surprised. He was like, yes, I am. And I was like, oh, my God, I know who you are and blah, 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 blah. And he goes, oh, that's great. 4 days later, ding dong. And I talked to him. I told him my apes fandom and stuff. 4 days later, my doorbell rings, open the door, and he's there, and he's got an extras chimpanzee mask and a gorilla appliance. And he just goes, here, you should have these if you like the stuff though so much. I just got it at my house.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, no, I can't take it. I don't want it.
So, did you put the mask on and then blow him? Because that seems like the only acceptable thing to do at that point.
I put the mask on. And I did put the mask on, and what happened was then I exhaled without taking into account that for 20 years, the latex had been off-gassing in the muzzle. And the muzzle is then designed to funnel all of that chemical detritus up into my eyeballs.
Ugh.
And I was literally like bent over full at the waist as if on a hinge. And I think I said like, and I thought, what a way to go blind.
Yeah. Still the happiest, one of the happiest moments of your life, right?
Yeah, but I did. I vigorously tore it off.
Oh my God. You're
I wish there was footage of that because I must have looked pretty great.
There are so many things I want to talk to you about. I want to talk to you about your obsession with Ed Wood and Planet of the Apes and just sort of your comic book and Comic-Con obsessions, but also I want to talk to you about stand-up as well, and then maybe a little bit of The Simpsons, and then
and also your Joel Hodgson Husker Du story.
Okay, that's a great story.
What's the Joel Hodgson Husker Du story?
Very, very quickly, Joel Hodgson of Mystery Science Theater. When he was living in St. Paul, Minnesota, when he was just Mystery Science Theater was then a local show called Mystery Science Theater 2000 that was just on a television in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And he had a workshop warehouse in St. Paul where he built toys and stuff. And Crow and Cambot all came out of there. And next, across the hall, was the rehearsal space for the band Husker Du.
Uh-huh.
And they were just friends. And so I was over there, and they were like, hey, they're having a listening party for their new album. I think it was Warehouse, named after the warehouse where their spaces were.
Sure.
So let's go over. And it's me and Joel, and we're just like dorky jackballs and cargo pants and a bunch of Minneapolis scenesters. And the thing about Husker Du was, like, they attracted scenesters, but they weren't. They were just dorky guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so Joel was standing in front of the stage bumming out all the hipsters by playing very aggressive air guitar, which I then immediately joined in on. And to the and it was great because they were dying with laughter. The hipsters were so bummed out that dorks were ruining their hipster private invitation-only party. And it was only made worse when Joel looked at me and at one point went, after a song, when it got really quiet, the girls aren't looking. Make your guitar bigger. And then like fully extended our arms and we're playing. And they were Grant Hart and those and Bob Mould and those people were laughing very hard. And that was really when I met Joel just before Mystery Science Theater happened. And it was great because it was sort of like, yeah, I'm in that group.
Yeah.
You know, when you're kind of coming around, coming of age, and you don't really know, what group am I in?
Yeah.
I'm not in this, I'm not in the hip group. And there was the hip group, and there was like the tough guy comic group, the sort of like the,
yeah,
you know, the smooth dude group.
Who was in that group?
I don't want to name names.
Okay.
But it's, you know, guys that leave the house in sweatpants.
Sure.
Kind of deal. And I didn't feel comfortable with them. And then I met Joel. I was like, oh yeah, that's my group.
Every time I see a guy with sweatpants on outside during the day, I just imagine that he fucks all the time.
Yeah. And he's just got no underwear underneath.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Just ready to go.
When I worked at the record store in Venice Beach, I would see that a lot. Just a couple coming in just in sweatpants.
Yeah.
And I was like, you guys fuck all the time.
Yeah,
probably.
We're taking a fuck break, and these are the easiest way to do that.
Yeah.
So what do people do when they're not fucking? I don't know. I guess they get a lemonade. All right, let's do that.
And the elastic around the ankles collects any residual dripping that occurs.
Yeah.
They're perfect pants. And they're made of basically cloth. They're just like, they're like towel pants.
Yeah.
Towel pants, yes.
Yeah, that's exactly
like,
there.
It's like walking around in your beat-off rag.
I just wore them because I didn't fit into the Husky Kid pants.
Husky tough skins. The pants made of shame.
Tough skin.
That's about right. We're poor. That's what I had to wear. Husky tough skins. I'm fat and poor. Yeah.
These pants, they're basically, the name is telling you that they're so durable that your chubby little body won't fuck them up. That's the tough skins.
You're poor and fat.
Or as my mother would say, it's so your waist gets bigger, you know. You'll fit in the pants.
Oh,
geez, she was planning on.
Hey, she knows. She's a wise woman.
Come here, Mama's little angel needs another pie.
What? Why are you doing this to me?
An entire pie.
Come on, you gotta fit in the tough skins.
You need carbs.
Well, I had been a fan of your comedy in the 80s, and then I met you. I really was, though, because there was
so old.
I know. It sucks.
So fucking old.
It sucks. I'm not that much younger than you, and so
no, you're not. Gross. I'm not that old. I just started crazily young. I started when I was 17.
Oh shit!
And I was a working touring middle by the time I was 21.
But you had a voice in comedy for me that, you know, so much of the 80s comedy boom was about very low impact, you know, comedy first, no real substance, but just like, hey, we're just going to distract people in comedy clubs so they buy drinks and food.
During Seinfeld, the Reagan years?
Yes.
Yeah.
Seinfeld was the, you know, progenitor of that with the suit jacket sleeve rolled up to the elbows. And it was all, and it was, I mean, he happens to be excellent at it, but it was a celebration of minutiae. And people forget it was so common back then. There was a sketch on SNL about it when Tom Hanks was on SNL.
Stand up and win?
Yeah. Well, they had that, here she comes and there she goes.
Yeah.
I mean, it was basically people doing Seinfeld. Yeah. And then once he got on the show Seinfeld and it found its voice, all that sort of style became codified as like, no, that's great. But for a long time, it was almost a cliche, not because of Jerry, but because of the legion of sub-Jerrys
right.
that were all over the place. It was a really a facile thing to rip off if you were an uninspired performer.
Legion of Subjaries is my Grateful Dead cover band.
Legion of Subjaries is my chat room name.
It's all little people, right?
Little people playing Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
That was the original name of Jerry's kids when the MDA comes on.
Legion of Subjaries.
And it was sub...
That was the telethon.
Sub in height, age, and genetics.
We're trying to create a Legion of Sub-Jerrys.
The Legion of Sub-Deans. People that can't walk with the braces.
Welcome to the Legion of Sub-Jerrys.
But your comedy to me was always, I always gravitated toward it for several reasons. Number one, because the bits were longer story bits, and you actually were talking about real things that you were dealing with,
yes,
and finding comedy in that. And also, in my mind, you were the master of what I describe as, like, there's an eloquent filth to some of the things that you write, and it made me well, because I always start writing from the I always go right to filth, and I always beat myself up about it, like, no, not again, but you do it in such a way that makes me feel like, oh no, there is a way to do it where it's okay and still funny and still, you know.
Well, that's also, you know, that came from a lot of, you know, all of that stuff. None of that stuff in anybody's style is ever intentional. It's always how you develop, and then people ascribe what they think it is after the fact. I never set out to do anything different. I was just like, this is the way that I'm funny.
Yeah.
I certainly ripped off, you know, like Albert Brooks's stand-up. If you listen to the stand-up sections of Comedy Minus One.
Mm-hmm.
Were a huge impact on me, because I realized I didn't have to write a bit about, you know, pens. He just talked about going on stage at a Richie Havens concert, and it was just a way of talking about his life that it was like, oh, what an easy way to come up with material. If I just wake up and do shit, I'll have material.
Yep.
And there's a guy named from Boston named Kenny Rogerson, who I took a lot from, not in material, but in just of his. He loved dark shit the way I love dark shit. And he sort of showed me a way to talk about dark stuff in a way that was funny and not just like dead baby jokes.
Right.
You know,
although you do have one of my favorite dead baby jokes of all time.
I do. I didn't even know.
You
I
said
had
it
one.
On stage at Largo once, and I felt like it was a thing that you may have never said again.
I can assure you it probably is.
This was probably 10 or 11 years ago. You said you were talking about Whoopi Goldberg, and you go, Whoopi Goldberg's about as funny as coming home from a dead baby's funeral and seeing its toy box in the living room.
Yes. that's my dad's joke.
Oh, Jesus.
My dad frequently says. My father frequently says, about as funny as a dead baby's toy box. That's funny. That's really funny. That's my father's.
And that was one of those ones that just latched onto my brain, and I'm like, I will never forget that as long as I live.
I like that because it's not necessarily about the dead baby. It's about the results of it and just being at home in the aftermath.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, a great way to sum up that with eloquent filth. I mean, that leads you to eloquent filth. And, you know, I'll give you an example of, like, the way that I could never do something painful. And then I would see Kenny talk about his stuff was all sort of like a darker Stephen Wright. It was and like fictitious whimsy. Like he would do here's a Kenny Rogerson joke. Great comedian, still working, lives in Boston, I believe. Sometimes I like to go to the laundromats with the big glass doors on the machines, and I'll just throw in like a doll's head, couple arms, and walk around going, "Has anybody seen Katie?" And I was just like, that kind of like, oh, I like that laugh because it's uncomfortable. But I would do a thing where I would talk about my girlfriend broke up with me, but she's moved on, and I'm happy, and she's happy. And then I would just stop and be really quiet for like 20 seconds. Because that's great, because now you have the audience's attention, because they don't know if you've really snapped or if you're pretending to snap, and they don't know what's coming next. Surprise is the strongest tool in the comedian's toolbox. And then I would go, no, she's fucking right now. I can feel it. Oh, I can feel it. And then I would just like bend over the waist and start rubbing my, it's like she's fucking me.
Now, how do you get away? Because
and then I would like fall down, and then I go, no, who am I kidding? I'm sure they're done. Lying there in the warm, loving afterglow as she wipes the cum off his dick with an old photo of me. And that's the kind of thing that you would like assemble, like how would Philip Roth write this? And he's just like, what's the harshest image I can conjure?
That is such a difficult line to walk, though, because so many, particularly comedy club audiences, are a little pre-programmed to immediately just go before you even finish what you're saying. Yeah. So how do you keep them
authority?
Yeah,
authority. I mean, the great thing about taking long pauses and maintaining, it's all crowd control. And if you and I had the good fortune of starting out in Boston, which is really a rough comedy town. I mean, the audiences are, if you better be good real quick or they'll kill you. You know, it's a lot like London in a way. It's a very contact sport for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like where I moved later to San Francisco, where you go on stage and everybody is in a beret and applauding politely and three people are starting your fan club. It's like, you know, it's definitely, it's like, you know, you go on stage and there's a guy doing a cat abortion in the front row and, you know, so you got to really get their attention quick. So you learn to have very good muscles in terms of crowd control.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just stand there and stare down the crowd and let them know that you are not afraid of them and that you are in charge. And you don't need to talk to do that. You can tell. Mm-hmm. You can tell. That's how you do it. And that's really fun. I mean, I to this day in my act, I always have something that I will do where the audience gets lost. Like they don't know what I'm doing and they don't know what's coming next and they get off center. And that's great because it really just affirms, no, I'm in charge. You're here.
I think you're sort of the father. I think the sort of godfather of, I see a lot of you in that sort of what ended up being called the alternative comedy movement that started around 91. I see a lot of your voice trickle down to some very famous comedians within that world.
You mean people who make more money than me?
But I see, and I even see, you know, I mean, I will readily admit that you're someone that I sort of get in my head sometimes when I'm writing, like, this isn't.
But that's how you do it. That's exactly how it works.
But it's more of a writer's approach to comedy rather than a clown's approach to comedy, where you can create comedy by weaving this really incredible imagery together without having to have here's a bunch of things, and here's the joke. It's all about taking people on this really, really wonderful journey that through a story with just the words and the metaphors and that's something that I love.
Oh, that's great. No, and I also think, I mean, I was certainly doing it. I was one of the, when the alternative movement started here in LA in the 90s, I was one of the few people that would do all of those shows and then also go over to the improv and do it in a straight club or go on the road, because I was of all the people that started in our little group of like me and Janine Garofalo and Kathy Griffin and Bob Odenkirk and David Cross and that little group, I was the only one that really worked regularly in comedy clubs.
Because started there.
And then Andy Kindler and all those people. I'm leaving out names, but it was your social group. It was the people I went to movies.
Those Janines, like the Janine Cross group, you had already been a touring comic before that scene. And
yes.
I think that scene of Janine and David and all those guys and Kathy and Greg Barron, like that sort of evolved out of, well, we can't perform in clubs or we don't want to perform in clubs. Well, so we're just going to perform.
Having been there the day of the conversation, I'll tell you exactly what it was.
Holy shit.
It was Janine having the very astute observation that in LA, there was no place to experiment. Because you go to the improv and you want to write and do some new stuff. And then you find out, oh, great. Jim McCauley from The Tonight Show is there and he saw me tank. Because I was trying something new. And so we wanted a place to bomb if we had to bomb. And that's all it was. And the other thing, it was just quite simply, by that point in time, the comedy boom of the 80s and early 90s had really, as I've said before, reached its point of putrescence. And comedy fans weren't in comedy clubs because they were the least funny entertainment option.
Right.
It was, you know, it was just like there are three comedy clubs in every town. And someone said this, I think this was Jerry Seinfeld's story. The arc of the comedy boom in the 80s was in the early 80s, you'd bump into somebody and they'd go, what do you do? And they go, well, I'm a comedian. They go, oh, that's really interesting. What's that like? And in the mid to late 80s, it'd be like, what do you do? And you go, I'm a comedian. And they go, oh, yeah, my brother-in-law's a comedian. And then in the early 90s, it'd be like, what do you do? I'm a comedian. Yeah, me too. I mean, it was so everywhere. We wanted to just find a place where we could go and bomb and experiment. So we went to this place called Big and Tall Books on Beverly Boulevard, and it was like a hipster bookstore with a performance area upstairs. And we said, okay, and we just rules to keep it interesting. You can't do your material. You have to do new stuff. You have to do new stuff that you've done. And then that was the rule. So you'd write it down and then bring your notebook on stage with you because you didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the birth of having your notebook on stage with you, which later somehow got misconstrued as don't practice. Don't be prepared. No, you're wrong. It's a job. It's a show. We had our notebook with because I didn't have time to memorize it. I'd written it 3 hours before.
That's how I interpreted it when I first started doing comedy. Because I used to come to the Un Cabaret shows at Luna Park when I was in college, and that's where I first met you in like 91. And so what I took from that is, oh no, when you go on stage, if you want to be cool, you have to bring your notebook and you have to not be familiar with the bits. And I bombed so many times not knowing where the, you know.
Oh, I know everybody thought that.
Yeah. So I am guilty of that.
I didn't want to be the old guy going, you know, kids, that was the best advice I ever got in stand up was because I was at that time, I was working in all of these clubs with Andy Kindler and Kathy Griffin and Janine and all these, you know, as I've said, that period of my time, it was just a blur of people in suede jackets writing on their hand. and then I would go out on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday and do the Addison Improv with Kevin Rooney or with Bill Maher or Larry Miller. And so I had my feet in two generations of comedians. I'm very good friends with all of that. Bill Maher, Kevin Rooney, Larry Miller, all those guys, because I worked with them all when I was a kid. And I was with my peers, Janine and everybody else. But I would go out and do all the stuff that I was doing in the alternative rooms. And I was very angry that the audience weren't ready for it because I would just go on like I was at Luna Park.
Mm-hmm.
And people were like, what the fuck is this? You're in Dallas.
Yeah.
and then Kevin Rooney said one night, you know, it's a show. You're doing what you're doing, but it's still a show. There's a mic and a light, and you're on a higher plane than everyone else. You're up on a box. It's a show. And they want to like you. But the precursor to that is they want to at least think that you like them.
Right.
And the minute those two, and he said them just like that in one day, in 1 minute, and I was a better comedian the next show because just by my attitude towards what I was doing changed. I was able to do all the same stuff. But I was just a more open performer about it. It wasn't like, here's something else you're not going to get.
Oh, that's
it was, let me show you something.
That's such baby. And that's almost, I see that like with baby comics sometimes where they feel like.
And it's just fear.
I guess it is. They control the situation more by, at least in their own minds, like, I'm going to write so far over the audience's head. They're not even going to fucking know, because I'm smarter than they are. And the second you do that, it's like, well, then neither one of you are really enjoying that experience, I don't think.
Well, it's you're not going to, I'm not going to be vulnerable and try my best and then bomb. I'll tell you I'm going to bomb, and I'll be in charge of the situation.
When you started doing that, like when you started to treat it more as a show, did you feel like, you had to change anything verbally, or would you sort of just...
No,
just
not at all. Attitude? It was just attitude. It's just attitude. And I get that, and you realize that a lot, like, when you talk about, you know, when you do politics, like, when I go on, like, Real Time with Bill Maher or something like that, you know, I'm a bomb-throwing progressive like anybody else, probably listening to this, but I have great friends that are on the other side of the political spectrum, and I've talk to people that I really don't like. But if you just like, okay, I understand your perspective. And I understand that you think that the way you do. Here, let me ask you a question from my point of view. And you'll find when you do that, people are just much more open. Instead of just going like all internet conversations like, I like this, you're a communist, you're a fascist, end of conversation.
Right.
You know, if you're just like, I understand... You're an American, I'm an American, we both love our country, we have very different views about it. Explain to me why this happens. And I go crazy.
Well, that is the first, that is the first rule of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Seek first to understand. Seek first. So few people actually want to shove their point of view in your fucking face rather than actually trying to understand the situation.
That's very interesting you say that. I had a friend who was a comic back from those days who had that book and said, it's a really great book. You should really read it. And I bought it and I never opened it and ended up giving it away at a show at Luna Park. I had a show at Luna Park where I gave away all my self-help books. All of them unopened. And that one specifically, I remember being not remotely creased. And the
like
guy
not even
who,
a flip through.
And the guy who read it was Judd Apatow. The guy who said, you should read this book. I'm like, oh, whatever. Whatever.
All right, Judd.
Good luck.
Were you on that Young Comedian special in 93, Judd?
Good luck, pal.
I remember that young comedian special that had Ray Romano, Janine.
Tempe, Arizona.
They put her in a flower print dress.
Yes.
Clearly someone was trying to girl her up in the traditional sense. Judd Apatow, Bill Bellamy, and I think Dana Carvey hosted, maybe.
I think that was in Tempe, Arizona.
Yeah, and a young, spry Andy Kindler who was jumping around on stage like a grasshopper.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was an interesting special, if anyone can dig it up. Because you're watching a lot of people really on the precipice of figuring out who they are. And then seeing where they ended up going and seeing that was kind of their first big television thing. Yeah. I mean, Romano was like 34 when he did that.
Yeah. And I have a lot of television I wish wasn't television.
I remember watching you in 94. I went to see Buster's Happy Hour. The Buster Poindexter comedy show that VH1 was doing.
I know what you're talking about.
Yes. This was one of my favorite moments of all time, is that Buster introduces the next comic who's supposed to be Dana, but there's a fuck up in the prompter or the cue card or whatever. So he introduces Carlos Mencia, and he goes, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage, Carlos Mencia. And then Dana walks out without missing a beat going, hey, everybody, it's crazy to be Latino. And it's like everyone fucking lost their minds. Of course, they didn't use it, but that was an amazing, such an amazing moment.
My favorite story from like that period, when I was doing all those shows, when literally every channel had 18 stand-up shows, I was doing the A-list. Which by the second
Sandra Bernhard's A-list?
This was the first season, the Richard Lewis A-list.
Yeah. Okay.
But it was the A-list, and then Sandra Bernhard took it over and it became a list. but I was standing backstage with Richard Lewis, who I lived one house away from at the time in Los Angeles. I've never talked to him, but I see him every day. And we're standing backstage, and I'm about to say, you know, I'm your neighbor. I live right next to you. On blank blank drive. And I go, you know, and he just goes, I can't talk right now. I'm getting ready to go on. Please. I can't talk right now.
Wow.
Jeez.
Go fuck myself.
Wow.
He really is that neurotic.
He really is. And I never said it. I was like, all right. Fuck you.
He tried to say it afterwards. He's like, don't talk to me right now. I'm coming off of the stage.
Really?
Don't talk to me. I'm not doing anything at the moment.
It really exploded.
And then I think you've been pretty public about this, at least in your stand-up and stuff that I've seen at Largo. But shortly after that period, you had kind of a meltdown.
Yeah.
So what happened exactly?
I had a little comic book store called Meltdown. No, I started doing stand-up really, really young, and I just did it all through college and did it all the time. I mean, it was my whole life, and I really drove myself really hard, and I was. I was just on stage in San Francisco, and by that time I was headlining, and I was in my mid-20s, and I remember I was doing 3 one-hour shows that night. And I was about 20 minutes into my first show. And you know, when you're on stage, you can have the flu, and you walk on stage, and you're fine.
Yeah, adrenaline.
Yeah, and then it's over. But I'd done it so much, and it was that went away. The adrenaline went away, and I literally just had what I know now. I didn't know it at the time. I had a panic attack in the middle of a set, and I was just on stage, and I just thought, I can't be here. Like, my heart was racing. I was outside of myself, looking at myself. I don't know if you've ever had a panic attack.
Oh yeah, many.
Yeah, you know what they're like. And to have it on stage and knowing, like, not only do I have to do another 40 minutes, I have to do it 2 more times. And I just like I just said I forget what I said exactly, but I said I'll be right back, and I just walked off stage. And
what club?
Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco. And I walked off stage, and the owner of the club, the a man who has the name Tom Sawyer, he was whittling when I walked up. I walked off stage.
Trick somebody to paint a fence for him. Yeah. I walked,
you keep paying me in glass doorknobs. I walked out of the showroom, and he was sitting in the front area, and he just went. He looked up at me and looked down at his watch and went, who's on stage right now? And I went, no one. And I just walked into the bathroom and just kind of stood in the stall for a minute, like, ah. And then it was like, and then the fact that I did walk off made it like, okay, you can leave if you have to. And I sort of collected myself, walked back on stage, finished the show, finished both shows. And, but then I just had, you know, I had stage fright for like 2 years.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Just for having never had it. Paralyzing stage fright that, there I'd have another panic attack on stage and just sort of melted down. And when, you know, when you're 26, 27, if you don't flip out, you've done something wrong.
You think, you know, so?
I think everybody around that time, you sort of crash and burn to one degree or another. And I, you know, I was raised largely unsupervised. I was the fifth child of six kids with parents that had other things to do than watch kids drink. And so I was, you know, I kind of parented myself, and I wasn't a very good, I didn't have good boundaries for me. I wasn't a great parent to me.
To yourself.
I wasn't a good parent to me. And then you learn, you know, and then you figured it out, and, you know, and you just go forward.
The panic attacks.
Fortunately, I pimped it out into like a one man show, and so it paid for itself.
Well, no, that's good. I mean, to be able to do something constructive with something horrible like that is sort of the gift of what it means to be an artist, I think.
Yes, and it's a terrible thing when you don't know what's going on, and you think you're going crazy. I mean, that's the, like, 'cause I didn't know what panic attack was. I didn't know what panic disorder was. I didn't know what, you know, I couldn't. And then it was like another. Period of time, there's like I went like 11 days without ever sleeping more than two and a half hours a night.
I had something very similar when I was 20, and I didn't know what it was at the time. And it feels like it's a physical thing.
You're dying.
You think you're dying, and then the panic attack becomes like a shock collar, like a dog. Like they start living in fear of the shock.
Yes.
Without ever actually, I mean, like if you use a shock collar on a dog, you only really have to do it once or twice.
Yeah.
And then after that, there's a little beeping sound that precedes the shock, and it's just the beep. And then they fear, and that's the same thing with panic attacks.
It's a vicious circle because the anxiety of the panic attack produces the panic attack, and insomnia is the worst thing in the world. And but then if you learn, no, that's somnambulistic hypervigilance. Your body feels under siege and refuses to let itself relax because it feels threatened.
When someone told you that was the thing, that must have changed it for you almost instantly.
It's like your jaw drops like a droopy cartoon.
Yep.
And then you just get, you know, get some pills and get your life together.
And so
pills and surgery.
Good advice, kids. Get some pills and get your life
just
together.
Some trepanning will take care of that.
It was true. You know, I went to all of these homeopathic people, and they were all a waste of time and money. It was just an utter avalanche of new age bullshit that did nothing. And I really want to believe a lot of that stuff. But if you go to a foot reflexologist and say, my car doesn't work, they'll find out a way to solve your car through foot reflexology. And I got some pills, and they were awesome. It took them for a long time.
Well,
and my new agey friends would go, you know, you're still feeling your anxiety. You're just masking it with medication. I was like, yes! That's what it says on the label of the fucking pill. You know, in the wintertime, I still feel the cold. I mask it with a coat. What is your addiction to suffering? You know, move on.
I always found that with panic attacks, that when I realized that it was a physiological reaction, and I realized like, oh, if I can keep my heart rate down, it's not going to pump adrenaline through my body at 100 miles an hour. And you can't relax and have a panic attack at the exact same time. It's impossible.
Yes.
So if you can keep your heart rate down, then that doesn't cure everything forever, but it is very, you know, you get to that point where you're like, oh, is this the crossroads? Am I about to freak out?
Yeah.
And if you can ebb that before you go into that mode.
And comedians and musicians who've never had that aren't
that great. You know, I believe that people that are driven to those extremes in their behavior, that also allows them to go to more creative places. I mean, if you don't, you know, show me a guy that doesn't have problems and I'll show you a really boring performer and a really uninteresting writer. Because you have to write from those things. And it's more true even musically, I mean, than anything else. Once you do realize that and you're able to step back and still use it but live your life happily, that's the goal. It's tricky because for a while you're living like with a gun to your own head because you don't know if you're going to be.
Yeah.
It's a terrible feeling to think like, oh, I just wish I was like everybody else. People just go to the movies and have fun.
Yeah.
You know.
But then the truth is that a lot of those people are probably...
Yeah.
Screaming inside.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah. And you're just like walking around your apartment going, I can't jerk off again.
Yeah,
my
you can.
My cock looks like the handlebar grip of a child's bike. I'm going to cum streamers.
Mine looks like a beginner ceramic ashtray.
There you go. Yeah.
But I just want to shift gears.
When your cock looks like, I'm not a stress ball. Yes, you are.
I want to shift gears a little bit because I want to get to your obsession with Ed Wood and Planet of the Apes and Vampirella and, you know, yep, like your relationship.
Fun stuff.
That's all great. That's all great stuff. Well, you and Jonah bonded pretty hard.
You're going to edit all of that other stuff out, right?
Yeah. It's gone.
I'm assuming these shows are heavily posted.
Yeah. We do a ton of...
We also auto-tune each and every one of our voices.
We're gonna Pro Tools the shit out of this. Yeah,
you know, exactly. we also gotta drop in the, you're listening to the Nerdist podcast. Yeah. But you guys bonded over Ed Wood, because that's Jonah's favorite movie.
I was astounded when you said that. I was so... I was like meeting a member of a secret club.
It does feel like that sometimes. Yeah. And it's not everyone likes that movie, but no one seems to love it as much as anyone else I ever met.
Oh,
like,
God, I love that movie so
much. It's my favorite movie of all time. And I don't know how it came up. We're just backstage at Meltdown and
we were talking about phones. You were showing me your phone for some reason.
Yeah.
And you showed me that you had the whole movie on your phone.
Yeah. I keep it with me.
Yeah. And I told him the weird story. You know, I have two really weird stories about that movie, but the one of them was that Joel Hodgson, I knew about Plan 9 from Outer Space through like Tom Kenny and those guys when I first started out. I had never seen Glenn or Glenda. I'd heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Kenny and his roommate at the time, later my roommate in Boston, a guy named Dan Spencer, showed me Glenn or Glenda and on an old, you know, and my head exploded. I just thought it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. And then I saw Plan 9 and I was like, I love this movie. There's just something about it. There's something. It's like when you listen to like an early punk record. Like, I don't want to say the Sex Pistols record because it was too well produced.
Yeah, that's a good
one. But if you listen to like Los Angeles by X, you know, you can.
Or any of those Germs, early Germs.
Yeah, early Germs, early Buzzcocks. You can just hear all the flaws and the missed chords and the bad playing.
And the stick accidentally hitting the rim instead of the drum.
Yeah. Yeah. But the intention is there. The intention is so clear that the passion for the music is so there. And Plan 9 is kind of the same way to me. He can't do a fucking thing right, but the intention is there. There's just nothing but affection for what he's trying to do. And I really do. It's that marriage of sort of like benevolent enthusiasm and profound incompetence.
But what makes that
come
just
together in a beautiful way?
But what makes that just like not bad, like William Hung? Like, well, that guy's very passionate about his music, but he can't really, you know, like, what is the difference between?
I don't know. It just sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. You know, the fact that he
Glenn or Glenda is great. Plan 9 from Outer Space is great. Orgy of the Dead, not that great.
Not that great.
The Ed Wood movie that I'm in, I Woke Up Early the Day I Died, made in 1998, off the last surviving Ed Wood script.
Holy shit.
Not that great. Not that great. But, you know, sometimes it just works, you know. That's the beautiful thing. It's inexplicable. You never know, you know. So he was showing me that. And my two stories about that is I was so into it. When that movie came out, I went berserk. I was like, I have to be in this movie. And I did audition for the movie, and I still have my script that I got from ICM with my part highlighted, which was Max Casella played it in the movie. Yeah. So that was weird. And then I ended up living the movie in a weird way. Because if you see the movie, there's a character, the character of Vampira, who was the first person to, like, ironically host horror movies on television. She was Elvira in the mid-50s.
I'm sorry, I said Vampirella.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. That doesn't matter. She's dead.
Okay.
Sure. nothing matters.
Nothing matters.
Well, of course
anymore.
She's dead. She's Vampira. She's been dead for thousands of years. Yeah.
She's now non-undead.
Oh, okay. All right.
I ended up interviewing her for a documentary I wanted to do about horror movie hosts, which is still the only job I think I'm really qualified to do. And we became really good friends. And she didn't have a telephone at the time. And I wrote her and this is 1995. Right after the movie came out, I did this documentary for the Sci-Fi Channel, met her, interviewed her, became her friend. And then I would just, like, she just seemed lonely. I'd write her, like, you know, she'd write me and I'd write her back. We lived in the same city, but we became pen pals because she didn't want a phone. She was very reclusive. And then I would take her out to lunch once a month, once every 2-3 weeks. And we just became friends. And then over the years, we just never stopped being friends. You know, we just constantly stayed friends.
How old is she at this time?
She's in her late 70s, early 80s. Then her sort of support group falls away. And I end up basically doing for her what Ed Wood did for Bela Lugosi in the movie that inspired me to contact her in the first place.
Wow.
And it was very bizarre. Of course, her real name was Myla Nurmi, and you forget then she just becomes your friend, and you forget that she's Vampira. And for a while, like, whenever I would see Plan 9, I'm like, oh, I got to call her, I think. I think I got to pay her gas bill or something. We helped her out. But the weirdest story was I had just started on The Simpsons, and I'd been there for, I guess, 2 years, and we had our first daughter. And so I just was crushed with time. You know, I've got a baby and a day job. And Myla calls me or writes me and says, I have to move. They're tearing down the building that I'm in. And it's like, okay. The one thing I don't have time to do right now is find first floor housing within 3 blocks of a supermarket for a woman in her early 80s on a fixed income with a dog and a cat that can't cross a four-way street to get to necessities.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into a store in North Hollywood called Halloween Town.
Yeah.
Which is a goth supply store.
Is that Wayne's store?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Wayne's store. It was, you know, if you want to go camping, you go to Big Five Sports. If you want to be goth, go to Halloween Town.
Yep.
They're your supply outlets. And I walked in, and there was a Vampira shirt on the wall. And I said, do you know anybody that I could pay to help me find an apartment for the woman on that shirt, the real woman? And they just went, yes. As if my coming was predicted in their ancient texts.
It says, and then it's all like in serigraph. Yes, there you are.
One day a man with tattooless arms will walk into the store.
That's Wayne and Jackie's store. Yeah, Wayne did the effects for House of a Thousand Corpses.
Right. Now, yeah, if you play the Danzig 2 record backwards, it tells of Dana Gould's coming.
Dana will come to rescue.
And so I met this lovely goth couple, Matt and Gab. He looked like Alice Cooper. She looked like
Alice Cooper
in drag. they're both lovely people. And they were just, you know, he was in a band trying to get going called Wednesday 13. And she was a photographer, and they knew who Myla was and loved her. And together, the three of us, and we looked quite odd. It's like, look at that goth couple and their parole officer. I don't know who the guy in the Izod shirt is. We became really wonderful friends, and we together found her a lovely place to live. And over the course of packing up her stuff, found like a bunch of money that she had. Like, oh, I thought I lost that. This is great. I was like, it was literally like. the greatest day, and we moved her in, and she was so happy. She was like, oh my God, this is a, she had a bungalow. She was, we got her one of the last bungalow courts in Hollywood. Like, she literally had her own bungalow. It was just, you couldn't have designed it better. And I'm sitting in her house on that day, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is good. You know, she found a bunch of money that she thought she'd lost, and she's in her bungalow court, and everybody's happy. And then I was literally, just as I had that feeling of like, this is a good thing. This is a good thing. I just hear behind me, ow, 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 ow. And I look around, and Mila's dog has bitten Gabrielle right in the tit.
Oh.
And it was just one of those like, oh. And so we spent that day, ended that day in the emergency room. Oh, jeez. Not in the, sternum would be a better place.
Oh, okay.
Didn't really, wasn't going for milk. No good deed goes unpunished. But that was, yeah, it was, and I'm still friends with them. That guy, Matt, is now Rob Zombie's bassist, known to the world as Piggy Demon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's who it is.
What a weird small world.
Yeah, do you know him? Do you know him?
I don't know him
do
very well.
Do you know Piggy? There's a question. I
don't know.
There's a question I haven't asked since I was in the Lord of the Flies cast. Where is that conch?
Hey, is that a boulder? Crush.
Yeah. Hey, look at that raw.
I feel like I probably do. Rob used to have these barbecues and have all like the band members come and like John Five and like these people and Blasco and all these people that would play with him, and those are really fun.
They're not together anymore. They're both moved on to different partners in life. I know them both. I'm good friends with them both. They're the nicest people on earth, both of them. And there was a time, I don't think he'll mind me saying this, and Milo's gone, where they had a problem in the building that she was living in, and she had they had a cockroach infestation. And, you know, it happens in low-income areas. So she had to go live in a hotel for a couple of days, and Matt and I had to go clean out this room in her apartment, which was had a problem. And so it was gnarly. So we ended up going to Home Depot and basically buying, like, hazmat suits because it was just cockroaches and cat pee and just stuff that it looked like a scene from the movie Seven.
Right.
Yeah.
And we were just looking at each other and these like booties and gloves and the mask and just like my eyes and just sweat and his eyes and mascara and sweat and just looking at each other and just in this fetid room, just laughing at the insipidness of the whole thing. But we'll always have that bond. I see him now, I email him now, and it's always like we were in Nam together. But he's one of those guys like, I'm going to space and I can't take my kidneys. Hang on to them. He'll hang on to them. They're both really nice.
And when did she pass away?
She passed away in January of 2008.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, or 2009, I forget. But she was, you know, she was one of those people that just, you know, there's famous people and who make a lot of money and they're well off. And then there's famous people that are famous, but then you don't realize that they're not making any money.
Right.
You know, and she just sort of survived. She's that, you know, and especially in Hollywood, people fall through the cracks all the time. And I got to know her and she was lucky. We were both lucky because we both benefited from the friendship, but you know, the fact that we knew each other and were friends, that was a lucky thing for her because she didn't have anybody to help her move. And there aren't institutions set up to help a lot of seniors. So it was weird. The other weird thing about it was she was also friends because she was a very iconic character in the 50s and 50s LA. You know, when Vampire first came on in 1954, there was nothing like it on television. And if you look at the average show that was on television in 1954, it's early Ozzie and Harriet. I mean, it was the 50s, but it was really still the 40s. It was, you know, people think of the 50s, they're thinking of the very late 50s and the very early 60s. Elvis really reaching his peak in like 57. And it was a very primitive time. And she's in this low-cut dress with this 17-inch waist and making really off-color jokes. There was really nothing like her on television. It was a local show. It was only in Los Angeles. And within 2 months, she was in Time and Newsweek.
Wow.
And Life. It was a big splash. And so she became friends with a lot of flamboyant homosexuals that were a part of that sort of underground bohemian culture in Los Angeles at that time. And when she passed, I was through the LA coroner's office listed as the contact. And so for about a month, I was getting these calls with these tragic septuagenarian gay men from the 50s. But it was like, I would just get this message like, boop, Dana. It's Orlando Divine calling. They all had these insane names. I swear to Christ, I wish I said them. I got your name from Tulip de Ventura. And I am just beside myself. It's Cotton Smiles Terwilliger gave me your number, and I need to talk to you. I got your neighbor from Butterscotch La Jolla. And I need to talk about my life. And it was really cool.
Where is she buried now?
She was laid to rest in the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
She's in Hollywood Forever. Oh, that's nice.
Not only is she in Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and this is not intentional. But one of the, you know, she wanted to be cremated and all that, stuff you don't need to know. The plot that she has through not intentionally, she's right in front of Darren McGavin.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
He's always on her tail.
That's really, they did such an amazing job revitalizing Hollywood Forever.
Yeah,
it's really just kind of a cool place to just go.
Yeah, I became really good friends with them.
They're really great. Like the whole great. And the movies that they do during the summer.
Sinispia.
And it's such a great, such a great place.
It's a great place.
For people who don't know, Sinispia is and it's the reason I love living in Los Angeles. I really do. I couldn't, when I was a kid, I grew up watching like Emergency, SWAT, Adam 12. And all these Jack Webb shows, and they're all shot on location in LA. And I just like in the Brady Bunch, I was like, I want to live there. I never wanted to live in New York. I always wanted to live in LA, where when I was a kid growing up in Massachusetts, I was like, that's where I want to go.
Yeah.
And you go there to the Hollywood Forever Cemetery, and they show movies at night on the side of a mausoleum.
It's so great.
Yeah. And I'm like, I live in the right place.
Yeah.
This is like, and like nobody does Halloween the way LA does Halloween.
Yep. You know,
it's just like, it's just, nobody comes close.
I saw The Exorcist on the side of the mausoleum for Sinespia. And it's just like, you go, it's like the sun just goes down. Everyone brings blankets and lawn chairs. You pack a picnic. You see a fucking great movie on the side of the.
Hollywood Forever is literally the first place I went to when I came to LA.
Really?
I want to go to Hollywood Forever.
It's great. I've seen Pee Wee's Big Adventure there. I've seen Dawn of the Dead there. I smoked some pot and watched Holy Mountain, which I do not recommend doing. Do not recommend watching Holy Mountain stoned at a cemetery. It'll mess you up.
My oldest daughter's first outing, I believe, was we took her to see Night of the Hunter at Hollywood Forever. But I said to, it was funny, I said to my manager, I said, you got to go to this thing. It's great. And he's like, yeah, I have a really good friend in that mausoleum. I don't think I'm going to go. Like, oh, yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah. There's still people that had lives that are here.
It's weird. It's weird. I didn't go for the first year because I lived right next to it. I lived on El Centro and Willoughby, just right next to the cemetery. And I was like, nah, I don't know if I could do that. I never really liked cemeteries. And I finally went and I rode my bike in. I didn't have to wait in traffic. It was great. And just it was this one of the best experiences of my life. And then when I was leaving, I was like, wow, I should come to this every time. And then someone honked their horn and I turned my head and I crashed my bike and just tumbled over all these raised marble, Orthodox Russian Jew.
Yeah, there's a lot of that there.
And I just kept on hitting the corners of each one as I tumbled down. And
I
fell down face first.
It's funny to go to the cemetery. My address as a child was 9 Cemetery Street.
Oh, wow.
It was just this curvy road. This is absolutely true. It was a little curvy road in my hometown of Hopedale, Massachusetts. And at the end, I lived on the corner. I lived at the end. These are everything I'm about to tell you is true. I lived at the intersection of Cemetery Street and Hope Street.
Wow.
And if you go to my Facebook page and the photos, there's a photo of the sign. At the end of the street, the street ended and then there's the cemetery. At the end of the street lived my friend, Russell Putnam, Russell Irving Putnam. His initials were R.I.P. He grew up across the street from a cemetery. And we had this big gang of kids in my neighborhood. We grew up, and we would just go in the cemetery and play on our bikes because it was closer than the park. We were just like, when's dinner? Six. Oh, it's five. Let's just go to the cemetery.
Yeah.
And my mother still has this big article they wrote in the local paper, Hopedale Village Cemetery, place where children play.
And you couldn't help but read it out loud that way when you were
there. Yeah.
That's what I did. I would ride my bike to the top of the street and go to St. Mary's in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. There you go. You know. Yeah.
Technically in Tewksbury. It's in the town over, but right next to where I lived. And
famous alcoholic Jack Kerouac's hometown.
Yes. A lot of famous alcoholics. You know, you
got everyone thinks they're famous.
Crackheads,
alcoholics. We got them. But yeah, no, there was a frog pond up there, and I would go up to the cemetery and catch frogs all the time.
Oh yeah, when you go there, like get frogs. Weird,
yeah, and then I learned to drive.
Taking it back to Tom Sawyer.
Yeah. Yes.
All the
on a raft.
Who's on stage?
Cemeteries
He's
were
got
weird.
These bags of frogs. Who's on stage? Tom, he's no shoes. His pants are rolled up. Muddy toes.
Tom, if you put those frogs down, Sam Kennison needs some coke.
I've smuggled them in the frogs.
Tom was one of the first guys.
Lick these toads.
Tom Sawyer at Cobb's Comedy Club was one of the first guys to book Sam Kennison out of L.A.
No shit.
Yeah, Tom knows comedy.
Tom's great. I know him just from, you know, through doing stuff with SF Sketchfest and, you know, like performing a bunch.
He
I
knows
never,
comedy.
Never got to perform at the old Cobb's. I've only performed at the airplane hangar that is the new Cobb's.
Yeah, the new so Cobb's. Yeah. Well, there's the old Cobb's and the old Cobb's, which was where it used to be on a legendary club in San Francisco on Union Street or someplace. It was way down the wharf. It was right next to like Happy Time Donuts.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom booked Sam Kennison in like 1984 or 3. And Sam just did this bit about the guy at the donut store next door. He's like, yeah, you know, he's in there. You go in there next door. He's making donuts. And I'm just afraid I'm going to be in there one day like, hey, I'll have a crawler. Sure, hang on. Let me get to the crawler. Reaches to get a crawler. Comes out with a Magnum. I'm not what Daddy wanted!
I want to ask you a couple questions.
Oh, Sam, I watched you do so much cocaine.
Somewhere he's snorting a cloud.
Yeah, it's true. Where do all the clouds go?
They're pure clouds.
It's another day. Sam, how do you value these clouds?
These clouds.
I want to talk a little bit about your involvement with The Simpsons, because you did EP The Simpsons for a while.
Well, I co-EP'd it.
Co-EP this is
nothing.
But because now, you know, it was in the news because the ratings of the show have gone down, which, I mean, listen, 22 seasons, I don't know. I mean, obviously.
The ratings of everything has gone down.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Although I do feel like in the last couple of years, what I've seen on the show, and tell me, I might be wrong about this, but it feels like, so they've hired a bunch of ex-Harvard Lampoon writers who are purposely making references to things that no one watching will understand unless they went to Harvard.
I don't know.
I will say this. I have three daughters. They're currently 2, 7, and 9.
Are you still working on The Simpsons?
No.
Oh, okay.
I did a voice, and I still go over there. I was over there last week to do a DVD commentary.
Yeah.
I will, on the lives, on my children's soul, I have not watched the show since I left.
Really?
I lived it 24 hours a day for 7 years, and I've just, there will always be something else I want to watch.
Right.
You know, I can't comment with any sense of authority about what's going on.
I don't
not love the show. I love it. It's a part of my life, but I don't I'm never watching that show again. It's like any show that you love and then you fall off and like, I gotta watch that.
Oh, I totally understand.
I gotta catch up on 11 seasons.
That's why we didn't go on the Simpsons. That's why you didn't want to go on the Simpsons ride at Universal Studios.
Well, there you go. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Because you went on a Simpsons ride for 7 years.
Yeah, we were at Universal Studios Halloween Haunt last Sunday and like, we're gonna go on the Simpsons ride. And I said something like, that's okay.
Yeah. I was like, me and Deanna are gonna go. Anyone else? And like, he was like, no.
I'm not one of these people who get
hey, here we go. It'll be like going to work.
But just make a little more queasy.
Yeah, but it is hard. Let me say in their defense, you really don't know how hard it is to come up with stories when you've got 23 seasons behind you of 22 episodes a season. And then you get to the point of like, we did that, we did that, we did that. And then you get to the point of like, well, we did that with Bart, but we haven't done it with Lisa. And then, you know, there are only so many ways to refract. And
I'm not negative about the show at all.
I know you're not being negative about that. And the network is also... changed the format of the show, or it used to be a three-act show, and now it's a four-act show, which I don't think is conducive to good storytelling. So they believe it or not, for a show that is as well-oiled as that, they still sometimes find themselves fighting an uphill battle. I left for a couple of reasons. One, I just felt like I felt done. I felt like it came time to come up with the episodes for the next season, and I had nothing. And I was just like, I think I'm just done. And I really miss performing. And I was also a big fan of myself and kind of wanted to get back to that.
Did you write the joke, monster put card in wallet?
That joke is in my episode.
Monster put card in wallet.
My favorite joke in that episode, that is from an episode called Papa's Got a Brand New Badge.
Okay.
Homer starts a home security company. Which, and all the episodes come from your experiences in life. That's how you do get stories. As long as you're alive, things are going to happen to you and you'll write about them. My wife and I bought our house. And the first thing you find out when you buy a house in LA is you have to get a private security company. Like the police aren't enough. There are people that are waiting, like coyotes. And so that was my experience with West Tech. And then they come over your house and it's like, well, what do you want? What kind of program do you want to get? I was like, well, I thought the one that you sold me over the phone was good. Well, let me just show you. Can I ask you a question? Do you like rape? No. Let me show you this. Oh, Jesus. Do you have a monkey sensor? I don't think I need one. What are you going to do when the apes take over? That's a pretty good point. Your wife comes home. Don't touch the bananas. Yeah. There's little bowls of raisins all over the house. Don't touch them. So we came up with that, and there was a commercial for Homer's Spring Shield, which was Homer's company, where a monster breaks in on a woman, and then Spring Shield comes in, and he goes, and the monster goes, friend? And Homer goes, you always have a friend with Spring Shield. And he gives him his card, and the monster goes, monster put in wallet. And I didn't write the joke. I didn't know who. I saw that it was like at the color test. I was like, who wrote that joke? Where'd that joke come from? And nobody could remember it. I had to track it down because it was so funny. And it was Tom Gamble of Gamble and Pross. And I just love that joke. It's so stupid.
What was that?
You're doing a commercial and there's a monster in the commercial, but the monster is real and doesn't understand that the commercial is a commercial. The monster is in a reality that you are not.
And he's still going to call him later.
Very meta. Very, very
meta. How long
did
it take to write a Simpsons episode?
About, you know, soup to nuts, it takes about, you know, 5 to 6 weeks. You get, you know, you break the story for a week, then you write an outline for a week, then you come back, do notes on the outline, then you get 2 weeks to write the script, you come back, and then they spend like 3 to 4 weeks rewriting the script.
And what was there a storyline?
It's not a great place to work if you think your words are precious.
Because it'll get...
Because it's hamburger.
What's the,
They just literally get your script, you read it, and then, okay, page one, interior, what do you want? I mean, it's just like... Don't it's a great because 99 times out of 100 your words aren't that precious,
right? Yeah.
So it's a great.
Was there a storyline that you could never get pushed through that you really thought like?
Yes, I wanted to do a story where Lisa became goth, and I just thought it would be a natural story, and I just could not sell it. I couldn't get it through.
Wow,
I tried for 7 years.
But that's like, you know, that's the next logical step after her becoming vegetarian.
It is. It's perfect. And part of it was right at the beginning, right when I started, was right when Columbine happened and goth had a bad, it wasn't, they weren't goth, but they got ascribed that. And that kind of queered it for a couple of years. And then I just couldn't sell it. And then Lisa getting into porn, which is another.
That didn't happen. They didn't do that.
Again, the natural step.
I mean, in today's. Porn. Such father issues.
In today's porn-soaked world.
The internet makes it so easy.
The only way to describe it. I was at the HBO Emmy party, and I saw Sasha Grey at the Emmy party. And I looked at her, and then I looked away and like, you don't want to see her. You don't want her to see you and think that you recognize her.
Right. Yeah.
And then I thought, the Pope knows who she is. You can't avoid it now. You can't turn on your computer without it.
without seeing a young girl get choked.
Yeah, it's really, it is. You are at the point of like, is this, are we done now?
She's into that weird fetish porn. I don't think this noise should ever get made during sex. Like, that's not a noise that you want to hear.
I don't want to hear a death rattle.
No.
When it,
well, and we're very close now to like the girls with no skin. We're running out of... We're running out of extremes to push. It's pretty much it's going to be like the Hellraiser guy. Just naked musculature.
Pinheads, the Cenobites.
Yeah. Oh, just naked musculature,
yep.
I think.
Oh, yeah. The guy.
Time to play with your clitoris. Boom, the chains come out.
Yeah.
Hook the vagina.
Exactly.
The box becomes a dildo.
The paint. Yeah, the puzzle box. Yeah.
It is amazing how quickly human beings, when left to their own devices, they just drill down. How deep can we go? That's like the old Lenny Bruce bit, leave a guy on a desert island and then an hour and a half he'll fuck mud. Like, where do we go?
Your wife, Sue.
What an interesting... What a weird job. What a weird step.
Fuck mud. Oh, your wife.
I'm sorry. In my head, I had anchored on to... I had anchored onto you being at the HBO Emmy party.
Oh, okay. Sasha Grey. Speaking of Sasha Grey getting banged. Speaking of Sasha Grey getting gangbanged, your grandmother was the first.
Look, I'm never going to work on HBO.
My wife?
But your wife was when my first like big agents at the United Talent Agency in 1994. Your wife Sue was one of my agents, and she was a junior agent at the time.
Yes,
and now runs HBO.
Yes, one of us has to be successful.
But you told an amazing story at Largo, where you were in the car with your kids, and one of them had to pee. And then you had the Ziploc bag.
Oh, yeah. We were on the highway. I was like, that could be any story. We were on the highway, and my daughter was really little and really had to pee, and it was like literally couldn't get off the highway going to Disneyland. And my wife was like, we had a Ziploc bag with like Doritos in it. We're just like, okay. Go in this, and my wife stood behind her and she nearly filled it. It's like she had, when did you drink a fish tank? And then she zips it tight, and then it just, there's this great picture of her, like, and then she's like making some big call, and she's on the phone holding like a groaning gallon bag of baby pee up to the window. It's like, you never know what the people on the other end of the phone are doing. But it's very strange because, like, I'm doing this show at Meltdown now called Carnival
with Koechner.
David Koechner, and I'll be on the phone and I'm like, look, we need to get two guys to dress up as clowns to do this one thing. It's a celebration of the lowest rung of the show business ladder. And I'm on the phone in the car, and then my wife will get a call, and you'll just see M. Scorsese. I have to take this call. Like, great. We need a bullhorn and a clown suit with a knife hole.
Well, we're almost out of time, Dana Gould. I do want to do one. I have so many of your bits that live in the back of my head.
I'm glad one of us does.
No, please. I always loved Don Knotts could never be a prank caller.
Oh, I have a great story. Yeah, it's a great bit, and then I'll close with a really sweet story. I grew up loving Don Knotts. Don Knotts won the Emmy every year. He played Barney Fife on the Andy Griffith Show. Won the Emmy every single year. And his voice was so incredibly specific that I realized that he could never make obscene phone calls. I'm sure he'd like to. There are nights when he's bored up at 4 a.m. in a dirty bathrobe and just pick up the phone.
Well, I've been looking at you through the bedroom window.
Is this Don Knotts? So, and then I did his voice on The Simpsons, and I ended up, my friend Larry Karaszewski, who wrote Ed Wood with Scott Alexander, his writing partner.
Yeah.
They're good friends of mine, and they were showing The Ghost and Mr. Chicken
at
Cine Family, a very underrated movie, very, very funny movie. And I was on this little panel talking about Don Knotts, and his daughter came up to me and said, I've heard that bit of yours on the Raw Dog, that bit you did about my father, and I just tensed up, and she went, oh, it was so funny.
Oh, that's...
And I was like, oh.
How dare you?
You must really hate your dad.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very sweet.
Well, Dana Gould, Carnival is a show that you and Koechner do at Meltdown once a month,
mm-hmm.
And that you are at Dana Gould on the Twitter.
At Dana J. Gould.
Dana J. Gould, you're at Dana J.
Gould. Dana Gould is some douchebag realtor.
What the fuck?
Yeah. I don't know he's a douchebag, but it's a safe assumption.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
I could talk to you for 4 more hours, but I won't because we don't have the disk space for it.
Okay. All right, then.
But
sounds so I understand. Right, blame technology.
I can hang out with you after.
No. You can.
No.
No. No. No. It's, if it's not recorded, it's not real.
No, but I'd love to have you back on the show again.
Anytime. If,
okay. Good. All right. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. Matt, Jonah, enjoy your fucking
enjoy it.
Is that code? Is that sex code?
Yeah. Well, there's a neurotoxin that's being slowly pumped into the room, and that's we're getting our masks. Oh.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover's domain name registration and management that is simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to HOVER.com/Nerdist.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.